Hello, I'm Nathan Robinson, editor of Current Affairs magazine. This episode of the Current Affairs podcast is part of Jubilee Week, 7 days of incredible interviews that we're releasing as part of our campaign to raise money to expand our magazine and improve our coverage in 2020. If you like this interview, please consider donating to our Kickstarter campaign. Visit kickstarter.com/project/80499229/help-current-affairs-expand-in-2020. The URL is also available in the show notes. Current Affairs has no advertisers or investors. We're 100% supported by readers and listeners, and we need your help to grow our magazine and build a serious, independent, left competitor to the mainstream media. Thank you for listening, and we appreciate your support.
Good evening, Current Affairs listeners. My name is Nathan Robinson. I'm the editor of Current Affairs magazine, and I'm here today with a dear friend of mine, Mr. Johan Hari. He is the author of 2 best-selling books, Chasing the Scream and Lost Connections, and he is currently working on about 3 or 4 more books at the same time, as I understand it. I'm very pleased to talk to you because I want to talk about things that are sort of common to both of your published books and also to sort of projects that you're working on now, as sort of common themes and such. I was just reading through Lost Connections last night. There's this wonderful little anecdote at the end that I hadn't really read before, and that is kind of not even on the theme of the book. But you talk about, this was funny to me, you talk about Andrew Sullivan, who I've never liked, by the way. But you have this story about him that made me really kind of soften on him a little bit. Because you have this lovely story about how in the early 90s, when he was diagnosed with HIV, he thought he was going to die. And he was one of the first advocates for gay marriage, and how absurd it seemed at that time that years later, everything that he was advocating for would come true. And it was like, for me, one of the most inspiring little things in the book.
You know, it's something I think about a lot, right? And I'm very happy to talk with you, Nathan. For many reasons, we've been friends for a while, and super happy to talk with you. I also feel like you and I converge in the middle, because you are the most British American person I know. And I feel like I'm one of the most American British people I know. Like, I messaged you earlier and I said, like, I'm so excited to do this interview, whoop, whoop. And you were like, that is way too much enthusiasm. And I thought, wow, we've crossed our national stereotypes, right?
You told me when I was just there, you told me that there's a thing in Britain that you can call people that is derogatory, which is that he's too keen. And I realized that I am in many ways too keen. And it sort of explained why I was getting, so I hadn't been back to Britain for 6 years, and it sort of explained why I was getting some of the reactions that I was from British people.
Yeah, British people, we're not big on enthusiasm. But no, Andrew Sullivan,
yes.
Was a British person who became an American.
Yes.
And, you know, I'd obviously, a lot of people know Andrew's work for more kind of conservative commentary. I think Andrew, who's someone I disagree with a lot, but I love as a person, and I'm hugely grateful to, actually, because of what he did. You know, you're totally right. When I get politically pessimistic, you know, you only have to glance at any news website to feel that nausea coming over you. I think a lot about Andrew, and I think a lot about that moment you described. So just to explain this to people, yeah. In 1993, it's the height of the AIDS crisis, and there's no hope in sight, as far as anyone knew. Or maybe a handful of scientists knew, but no, the wider public didn't. And Andrew was diagnosed as HIV positive, which he believed was a death sentence. His best friend, Patrick, had in fact just died of it. And Andrew quit his job. He was the editor of the New Republic. And he went to a little place in Cape Cod called Provincetown to die, right? And Andrew decided he was going to do one last thing before he died. He was going to write a book about a crazy utopian idea that nobody had ever written a book about. The idea he was the first person to advocate at book length was gay marriage, right? It's an amazing book. It's called Virtually Normal. And Andrew was like, okay, I'm never going to live to see this happen. Obviously, no one alive now is going to live to see this. Think about the insane homophobia of the height of the AIDS crisis. But maybe somewhere much further down the line, someone's going to pick up this idea. And when I get really depressed, I try to imagine going back to 1993 and going to Provincetown as a time traveler and saying to Andrew, okay, Andrew, you're not going to believe me, but 26 years from now, first thing, you're going to be alive. That would have seemed like an incredible miracle. Yeah. Secondly, you'll be married to a man, right? Which would have seemed incredible to him. Thirdly, I'll be with you when the Supreme Court of the United States names this book, cites and quotes from this book you're writing now, when it makes it mandatory for every state in the United States to introduce gay marriage. And the next day, you're going to be invited to a White House lit up in the colours of the rainbow flag by the president to celebrate what you and loads of other people have achieved. Oh, and by the way, that president is going to be black, yeah. Right? Every aspect of that would have sounded like the most insane science fiction. It'd be like me saying to you, Nathan, okay, Nathan, I know things are rough now, but 26 years from now, a transgender president who quotes from Current Affairs all
yeah.
is going to invite us to smoke crack with her in the other office, right?
It was when you said the White House lit up like the rainbow flag that I realized how much you... It did, in fact, seem like science fiction. That does sound crazy. Yeah.
It does. And, you know, but this is the thing that we... one of the crucial things we have to hold on to at this profoundly dark and disturbing moment, which is progress is possible, and we must never discount extraordinarily unlikely forms of progress can happen incredibly quickly. I mean, I think about things as basic as my grandmothers, when they got married, weren't allowed to have bank accounts in their own name. Right? Think about how recent that is. Yeah. My grandmother, not that long ago, right? And the tendency, I think, in these dark times, the temptation, which I feel as well, is to say, to focus on the horrific negative trends and discount the positive trends. Now, the horrific negative trends are very real and we need to fight them absolutely urgently and desperately. But I think we can only do that if we remember how progress happens. How did that progress happen, right? It did not come easily. We're speaking just before the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. You have 2,000 years of horrendous, you know, homophobia, and you have this extraordinarily rapid transformation in a very short period of time by people banding together, appealing to people in a spirit of love and compassion, not giving up even when it seemed really hard. And, you know, I'm gay. My whole life has been transformed by that. And we have to remember those.
It's worth appreciating, and it's sort of under-recognized just how dark the darkest days of the AIDS crisis were. Because, I mean, every time I read about some new interesting figure in gay culture and politics from the 60s or 70s, and you notice that half of them, half the interesting people sort of just were wiped. It's almost like World War One, where an entire generation of people is sort of wiped out. It really is a kind of Holocaust that is. Not remembered at all, and the amazing amount of change that has occurred.
I actually think if I was going to give people one political film to watch on any subject that would help them to see the power of organizing and fighting, I would give them the documentary How to Survive a Plague. Have you seen it, Nathan?
No.
I mean, literally just stop speaking to me and go and watch
okay.
it. There's also a great French film, which is not a documentary, but very close to what actually happened. 120 beats per minute, which is about the French equivalent of this story. But How to Survive a Plague is about, it's the story of ACT UP. So a group of HIV positive people who were gay men, some of them people who've been infected through blood transfusions and other people who contracted HIV in other ways, but mostly gay men and people who loved them, who at the height of the crisis, you know, I mean, monstrous homophobia. It's worth remembering President Reagan never says the word AIDS when he's president. The one time it's brought up at a White House press conference, the entire press corps laughs.
Yeah, I've read the transcript of that. It's so disturbing.
Extraordinary. And remember, this is like my lifetime, right? I mean, I was young, but it's my lifetime. And this extraordinarily brave group, ACT UP, form to demand that the AIDS crisis is taken seriously. And they really united with a group of dissident scientists because the FDA rules on the development of the drugs were effectively a death sentence for HIV-positive people. To me, it's this incredible story about, firstly, what their activism achieved, which is astonishing, what the scientists who supported them achieved in the face of stunningly wicked bigotry. There's this incredible moment in the documentary where, I'm ashamed to say I've forgotten the guy's name, but one of the central organizers, he says it much better than this, but he says something like, there's going to be a time, it seems impossible for us to see it now, when this plague will be over and they will remember whether we stood up and fought or not. And it will determine how soon this plague ends and how many people die. Of course, AIDS has not ended, but we can see the end in sight. You know, you and I might live to see the last, if it's enough concerted action, we might live to see the last person who's ever infected with HIV. That's a conceivable goal, right? The French equivalent of that, 120 beats per minute, is a really remarkable account. And that battle happened. I should also say the other group that was involved in that were people who'd been infected through intravenous drug use. So also, I interviewed for the French edition of my book about the drug war. It's called La Prima des Schlips in French. I interviewed Anne Capel, who was one of the leading figures in the French equivalent of ACT UP as well.
The one thing that I actually think is worth appreciating in the kind of Steven Pinker view of history, which is, oh, it's all getting better, we should appreciate more, all the progress that's been made, is that it is true that it's so easy to, the moment a thing has happened, take it for granted and forget what it was like to live in a time before. And it's so easy to take even things like the weekend or the eight-hour day for granted and forget how many people went through their entire lives without knowing these things. And I had this moment, I'm so encouraged almost by how unknowable the future is and how unpredictable it is. It was weird. For me, 2016 was almost a liberating year because it was the year that I realized that I had no idea what the future held and that anything could happen, and it was kind of exciting. I mean, you know, it was obviously truly horrible to see Trump get elected, but I realized that all of the people who thought that they knew the range of things that could happen didn't actually know the range of things that could happen. That was far, far broader towards both the horrendous and the possibly magnificent. And I mean, I don't know, if you went back and talked to your young self, he would probably be astonished by a number of the things that have happened in your life, just as my young self would be completely astonished by all of the things that have happened in my life. And I'm so fascinated by what's going to unfold over the next 30 or 50 years.
Have you read Hope in the Dark by Rebecca Solnit?
No, haven't read anything.
You would love this book. It's a great, it's a really...
This is just going to consist of you pointing out all the things I haven't read.
I'm sorry. No, so you would love this book. It's a little book, and I really recommend everyone listening read it. It's about political hope in very dark times. And she says several things in there that I think about all the time, that I was thinking about as you were speaking, that I think are really important. She says exactly, despair is a form of confidence about the future that isn't warranted.
Right.
You don't know what will happen. We can alter the future. There's a great line, she says, hope is not a lottery ticket that you sit on your sofa clutching, hoping your number comes up. Mm-hmm. Hope acts you use to break down the door in an emergency, right? Hope is not passive, hope is active. And I love that's a really important way of thinking about it, right? But to do that, you've got to give people a sense of agency. And we live in a culture that has very successfully stripped people of their sense of agency, right? That has made them feel there's nothing you can do. That is a total lie. You think about ACT, I think we're a tiny number of people. They saved enormous numbers of lives. Gay people, we were always a small minority, right? We transformed the society. What's the line Margaret Mead said, you know, never doubt that a small group of organized citizens can change the world. It's the only thing that ever has.
A friend of mine suggested recently that perhaps on the left, we have swung too far away from, we've understandably rejected the great man and woman view of history by which single individuals are responsible for massive historical changes. But in going towards the everything is systems, everything is forces, everything is things that are greater than you, it almost makes you feel as if you're riding on a wave that you can't control and reduces the ability that our sense that we are actually able to shape the world that we live in. I wonder if there's a better conception that we need.
That's so interesting. I mean, the more you do a systemic analysis of the forces in the society, the more you begin to see how arbitrary they are and how vulnerable they are to challenge. I actually don't think it's a choice between either you believe in individual agency or you believe in a systemic analysis. I think that when you do a systemic analysis, you realize that these systems can be challenged and changed. So I'll give you an example of one that I thought about a lot writing my book, Lost Connections, which is about why we're having such an epidemic of depression and anxiety across the Western world and what we can do about it. You know, we've been told this story that's dominated the culture, which says depression is just caused by a chemical imbalance in your brain, right? It's just caused by a problem in your biology, and the only solution in sight is to drug yourself. And it's true that there are some biological components to depression and anxiety, for sure. There's strong evidence for that, although none of them is a chemical imbalance. And it's true that drugs can give some people some relief and therefore have some value. But actually, I learned that there's scientific evidence for 9 causes of depression and anxiety, 2 of which are in our biology, but most of which are factors in the way we live. And as you were asking that, I was thinking about one of them in particular, which I think current affairs readers don't need me to tell them, to be sure. But, so I noticed that lots of the people I know who are depressed and anxious, their depression and anxiety focuses around their work. It turns out there was a very good detailed study by Gallup of how people feel about their work. And what it found was 13% of us, 13%, like our jobs most of the time. 63% are what they called sleepwalking. You don't like it, you don't hate it, you don't know how to tolerate it. And 24% of people fucking hate and fear their jobs, right? I was really struck by that. That means 87% of the people don't like the thing they're doing most of the time. And this thing they don't like doing is spreading over more and more of the day. The average person answers their first work email at 7:43 a.m. and leaves at 7 p.m., right? So I started to, that can't be, that figure about how many people don't like the thing they're doing most of the time, that figure can't be far off what it was in the Soviet Union, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty shocking thing. So I started to ask myself, could this be playing a role in the fact that we have a mental health crisis, the fact that we don't like the thing we're doing most of our waking lives? And I learned that there's a scientist who made a real breakthrough about this in the 1970s, an amazing man, Australian social scientist called Professor Michael Marmot, who I went to interview. And I can tell you how, if you like, because it's a really fascinating story. But the core of what he discovered is the biggest factor that causes depression at work, not the only one, but the biggest factor, is if you go to work tomorrow and you have low or no control over your work. If that's the case, you're way more likely to become depressed and anxious. I think this is related to a deeper thing, which is everyone knows they have natural physical needs. Obviously, you need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clean air. If I took those things away from you, you'd be in real trouble real fast. But there's equally strong evidence that all human beings have natural psychological needs, right? You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your work has meaning. You need to feel that you have a stable future. You need to feel there's this solid ground beneath your feet. This culture that we've built is good at lots of things, but we've been getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying psychological needs, the need for meaningful work being one of them, right? Now, that lack of control over work, I actually misunderstood what Professor Marmot was telling me at first, right? Because I thought what the meaning of this was, okay, you've got this elite 13% of people who get to have nice lives, who control their work, and then you've got everyone else who's condemned to the shit, right? And I thought about, you know, my grandmother's job was to clean toilets. My dad was a bus driver. My brother is an Uber driver. I was like, well, hang on, are you saying that all these people are just condemned to this miserable life? And he explained to me, it's not the work that makes you depressed. It's being controlled at work.
Right.
And there's a solution to that.
Yeah, it's great reading this part of Lost Connections, because I love that you basically propose radical democratic workplaces and basically the elimination of bosses as a solution to depression, which I think makes complete sense when you think about it. I mean, the things that you point out are very intuitive, but totally undiscussed, which is, you know, if you're being ordered about all day, if you don't feel, you know, if you feel alienated in the Marxist sense, you know, your labor is not your own. It isn't about the fact that your labor is tedious. It's about the fact that you have no control, that you have to sort of remove yourself from your body for this many hours a day. And then, of course, we should think about how would we structure a workplace in which people feel a sense of ownership and control.
This is not some kind of abstract proposal, right? This has been looked at carefully. So I spent a lot of time with a really great group people. So I went to Baltimore to interview a woman called Meredith Keough. And Meredith had been, you know, Meredith used to go to bed every Sunday night just sick with anxiety. She had an office job, but she would tell you it wasn't the worst office job in the world. She wasn't being harassed or bullied or anything, but it was monotonous. She had low control, and she couldn't bear the thought this was going to be the next 40 years of her life till she retired. So one day, Meredith, with her husband Josh, did this quite bold thing. Josh had worked in bike stores in Baltimore since he was a teenager, which is, you know, insecure, controlled work, right? You don't have any rights at work, basically. And one day, Josh and his colleagues were fixing the bikes, and they just turned to each other and said, one of them said, "What does our boss actually do?" They didn't hate their boss. He wasn't an asshole.
I think a lot of people have asked that question over the course of history.
And I'm sure a lot of people have also drawn the conclusion, we seem to fix all the bikes, and this other to make all the money, right? So they decided to do something different. They decided to set up a store of their own. It's called Baltimore Bicycle Works, that works on a different principle. So the place where they'd worked before was a corporation, right? Everyone knows what a corporation is and how it works. It's like a little tyranny with a dictator at the top. Sometimes it's a nice dictator, sometimes it's Kim Jong-un, but you have to please the dictator or you're out. And Josh and Meredith and their colleagues decided to set up a bike store that works on a different principle. It's actually an older American idea. Their store is a democratic cooperative. It's one of 50,000 democratic cooperatives in the United States. They don't have a boss. They make decisions about the future of the business together. In practice, they agree, but when they don't, they vote on it. They share the profits. They share out the good tasks and the shitty tasks, so no one gets stuck with the shitty tasks. And one of the things that was so striking to me talking to people there, which is totally in line with Professor Marmot's findings, is how many of them talked about how they'd been depressed and anxious in this previous way of working, but were not depressed and anxious now. And it's not like they quit their jobs fixing bikes and went off to become Beyoncé's backing singers, right? Yeah. They fixed bikes before, they fixed bikes now. The difference is now they've got control over their work. If you want to radically reduce depression in this society, I would say one of the things we should do is, you know, acknowledge there is no reason why we should be organizing our culture so that people spend most of their time in institutions that make them feel like shit. Every corporation can be turned into a democratic cooperative, right? And this isn't some crazy remote idea. Think about Germany.
Well, there's a line in your book that I thought would horrify half of America. You know, it turns out that our Western version of happiness doesn't actually work, whereas the collectivist vision of happiness does. And of course, you know, we come from a culture here where the word collectivist instantly is a nightmare word that you can use to denigrate any political opponent. But you point out very seriously that happiness has to be gotten in community, that when we're alone and when we are isolated, when we have no control, that we are unhappy, and that when we're working together on projects and working for each other and with each other, we're better off and happier. And it's a very obvious thing, and it shouldn't be controversial.
I mean, look, it's worth saying a few things. Firstly, we talk a talk against collectivism, and yet the most popular institutions in American society by far are Medicare and the army, which are the two institutions that do not run according to market individualism, right? So it's really worth bearing that in mind.
The army doesn't seem like the happiest place, to be fair.
No, it's not. I'm not making a point about people in the military being happy. I don't think they are. But I am making a point that this idea that, you know, this is a culture that's just irreconcilably hostile to collective institutions.
Right.
Not true, right? That actually when we see institutions that are not collective, we like them very much. Now, I said someone who's obviously very critical of the US military for all sorts of very good reasons. The point I'm making. But I think you're right about a big part of both my books has been arguing that these epidemics we have of depression, anxiety, and addiction have predominantly social causes. Mm-hmm. Not entirely. There's some aspects that relate to the individual psyche, and there are some aspects that relate to biology. The reason why they're rising is because of collective changes that have happened in the culture, right? And I think there's very strong scientific evidence for that. And it's not just me who thinks that. The World Health Organization, the leading medical body in the world, has been telling us that for years, although we've been ignoring them. You know, when I was a child, Margaret Thatcher said, there's no such thing as society, there's only individuals and their family. And I really see how much we've internalized that in actually the depression, anxiety, and addiction debate. So I'll give you an example. I had a slightly surreal experience. You know, Peter Thiel, the disgusting paper. Yeah. So I got an invitation from Peter Thiel. Among the many other things he does, he has a venture capital fund, and they were organizing a conference for app developers who were developing apps to deal with depression, anxiety, and addiction. And I got this invitation from Thiel to go and address it. And I was like, right, apps are not the solution to depression, anxiety, and addiction. And then, you know, they're like, yeah, that's great. Why don't you come and tell us? So, you know, I was kind of actually quite curious about what this would be journalistically. So I was like, okay, I'll go. So it was in San Francisco, and it was the day before Trump was inaugurated. Mm-hmm. I arrive, the last foreigner under the line before Trump becomes the president. And it was really a genuinely surreal experience. So it's a day-long conference, and there are loads of super distinguished scientists, including some people I really respect. Tom Ensel, who's the former head of NIH, National Institute of Health, David Eagleman, some really impressive people. And they speak for the whole day, not just them, lots of people. And I was speaking last. I don't know if this was by design. And if all you knew about depression, anxiety, and addiction was this day-long conference, you would literally assume they were just spontaneous problems in the brain. All anyone did was put up brain scans and talk about the brain, right? And I'm kind of standing there thinking, this is so bizarre to me. And when I go up and speak, I kind of said, you know, it's not that what they're saying is not good science, right? In the same way, you could describe the obesity epidemic. You could talk about obesity by looking at scans of people's stomachs and describing what happens inside people's stomachs, right? And that would be good science. That's necessary science. We want to understand what's happening in people's stomachs. But you wouldn't understand a damn thing about why the obesity crisis is happening, right? For that, you have to understand the food supply system and the fact that we have cities you can't walk around, and the fact that people are so stressed and anxious, they want to overeat, right? So I'm standing there, and I was trying to think, what should I say to these people? And I just end up saying, you know, I talked a bit about Rat Park, which I'll talk about in a minute if you want. But I just said, you know, let's not even discuss this. We were really near to the Tenderloin, an area with a lot of chaotic street addiction. I said, why don't we all just walk over to the Tenderloin, sit with the first person with an addiction problem that we see, sit down with them, listen to their life story, and then come back and tell me that the main thing that's gone wrong there is that their amygdala isn't functioning properly. It's ludicrous, right? It's absurd. It's using the wrong level of analysis. You describe the plot of Romeo and Juliet using Newtonian physics, right? It would all be good science, right? The atoms moving Romeo's body this way and that. You wouldn't understand a damn thing about... If you leave out the society, you cannot account for these problems. Why is it so much worse in West Virginia than on the faculty of Harvard when it comes to addiction, depression, and suicide?
Well, I mean, I saw critics of your book who were psychiatrists saying things like, oh, well, of course we don't just say, oh, it's chemicals in the brain. We would never reduce it to that. And yet, my personal experience has been that while they all say, oh, of course we understand the social causes of depression, I had not had depression in my life ever up until the time that I was in graduate school. I've been a perfectly happy person all my life. And then I went to graduate school at Harvard, and I became deeply, deeply depressed for the first time in my life. I'd never experienced it before. And it's quite obvious to me that it had a lot to do with graduate school itself. I mean, half the people I knew in graduate school were depressed. And you can trace it to the ways in which graduate school is structured. It's structured in a way that you feel very aimless and directionless. You have professors who are not really telling you what you ought to be doing, but seem very disappointed when you don't do it correctly, which is that's a recipe for constantly feeling anxious. I compare graduate school to like being in a room and someone says you can leave the room once you've passed the test, and you say, but what is the test? And they say, well, that's for you to figure out. And then you do something and you go, have I passed the test? And they go, no, you haven't passed the test. You go, what did I do wrong? And they go, well, you need to try again. And you just have to keep trying over and over. And that's a situation that would drive you crazy. And that's exactly what it is. And it's structured in a way that clearly has built-in dysfunction that is causing people to be depressed. And yet, when I went to the University Health Center, world class, talked to a psychiatrist that I really liked, I really got along with him, and he said, well, these are the antidepressants we can try for you, right? These are the various things we can put you on, and these are their effects, and why don't you try this one first? And then you had therapy. You could go to therapy, and in therapy, they'll talk to you about your problems, but you know, talking to you about your problems can't actually change the structure of graduate school. And if that is what is causing people to be depressed, then nothing that they can offer you at that clinic is going to address the causes of your depression. And nobody is talking about how the institution itself is clearly contributing to the mental health crisis that is facing all the graduate students.
I think that's a really good way of putting it. We have a mental health system that is premised on, okay, given that the environment is the way it is and we can't change that, what can we do to tinker with you in the kind of remaining niches that are available to us, right? And that's actually, there are lots of psychiatrists who are not happy with that, and there are lots of psychiatrists who praise my work, and my position is not some marginal position. My position is the position of the World Health Organization, the leading medical body in the world, who said we need to talk less about chemical imbalances and more about power imbalances. So the grad school example you just gave is a really good one. Let's think about that in a wider context. Half of all Americans, through no fault of their own, have less than $500 in savings if a disaster comes along, right? Now, that is going to have a profound effect on your emotional health. You're going to be really anxious, right? The collapse of the middle class has caused a lot of depression, anxiety, addiction, and despair, right? This is why Sir Angus Deighton and Professor Anne Case, two of the best social scientists in the world, have done an analysis of where are the opioid epidemic deaths happening. They're overwhelmingly happening in the places where people have been deprived of their basic psychological and in some cases physical needs, right? This is why they call them deaths of despair. There was one person who really helped me to think about this. It's a story I think about all the time. I went to interview this South African psychiatrist called Derek Summerfield. Derek happened to be in Cambodia in 2001 when chemical antidepressants were introduced for the first time in that country for Cambodians. And the local doctors, the Cambodians, had never heard of these drugs. So they were like, what are they? And so he explained. And they said to him, oh, we don't need them. we've already got antidepressants. And he said, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of, you know, herbal remedy, like St. John's wort or something. Instead, they told him a story. There was a farmer in their community who worked in the rice fields. And one day he got his leg blown off by a landmine left over from the US invasion of Southeast Asia. So they gave him an artificial leg. And after a while, he goes back to work in the rice fields. But apparently it's really painful to work underwater when you've got an artificial leg. I'm guessing it's pretty traumatic to go back and work in the fields where you got blown up by a landmine. The guy started to cry all day. He refused to get out of bed. He developed classic depression, right? So that's when the Cambodian doctor said to Dr. Summerfield, well, this is when we gave him an antidepressant. And he said, what? They explained that they went and sat with him. They listened to him. They realized that his pain made sense. It had perfectly understandable causes in his life. And one of the doctors figured, you know, if we bought this guy a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this position that was screwing him up so much. So they bought him a cow. Within a couple of weeks, his crying stopped. Within a month, his depression was gone. They said to Dr. Summerfield, so you see, doctor, that cow, that was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right? Now, if you've been raised to think about depression the way we have, that sounds like a joke. I went to my doctor for an antidepressant and she gave me a cow, right? Those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively, yeah. It's precisely what the leading scientific experts have been trying to tell us for years. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, you're not weak, you're not crazy. In the main, you're not a machine with broken parts. You're a human being with unmet needs. And what you need is practical love and help to get those deeper needs met, right?
I guess the obvious question that someone would ask you after hearing this, though, is that why are rich people so fucking depressed at the time, too? Why are people who have everything they could possibly want, if we ascribe it to material conditions and deprivation, you know, there are plenty of people in despair who seem to have everything they want in life.
So what I learned from the leading experts in the world on this is that there are scientific evidence for 9 causes of depression and anxiety. Some of them relate to financial insecurity. Some of them are actually worse at the top of the society. Some of them are worse at the bottom of the society, the economic ladder, and some of them are actually worse at the top. So I'll give you an example. Everyone knows that junk food has taken over our diets and made us physically sick, right? You know my love of junk food, Nathan, so I say this with no sense of superiority. But there's equally strong evidence that a kind of junk values have taken over our minds and made us mentally sick. So for thousands of years, philosophers have said, if you think life is about money and status and showing off, you're going to feel like shit, right? That's not an exact quote from Confucius, but that is the gist of what he said, right? But weirdly, nobody had scientifically investigated this until an incredible man who you should totally get to write for Current Affairs, he's extraordinary, called Professor Tim Kasser. He's at Knox College in Illinois. Professor Kasser did a whole series of kind of groundbreaking research on this. So there was already a body of scientific research that showed every human being is a mixture of 2 kinds of motive, right? So let's imagine that you play the piano, right? I'm totally unmusical, but you might play the piano. If you play the piano in the morning because you love it and it gives you joy, that's what's called an intrinsic reason to play the piano, right? You're not doing it to get anything out of it. You're just doing it because that's a moment when you feel flow and joy and meaning. Okay, now imagine you play the piano, not because you love it, but, I don't know, in a dive bar to pay the rent, or because your parents are massively pressuring you because it's their dream that you'll be a piano maestro, right? That would be an extrinsic reason to play the piano. You're not doing it because actually that experience is meaningful to you. You're doing it to get something out of it further down the line. Now, obviously, every human being, everyone you've ever met, is a mixture of both intrinsic and extrinsic motives. But Professor Kasser showed a few things. Firstly, the more you are driven by these extrinsic motives, the more your life is guided by thinking all the time about showing off and status and how you look to other people, the more likely you are to become depressed and anxious by a really quite significant amount. He also showed, as a society, we have become much more driven by these extrinsic values, right? And at first, when I was learning this, I kind of thought, you know, isn't this a bit kind of banal, right? Everyone knows you're not going to lie on your deathbed and think about all the likes you got on Instagram and all the shoes you bought. You're going to think about moments of love and meaning and connection. But as Professor Kasser puts it to me, under American capitalism, we live in a machine that is designed to get us to neglect what is important about life, right? That more 18-month-old children in the United States know what the McDonald's M means than know their own full name. For the moment you're born, you are immersed in a machinery that tells you, if you don't feel good, we've got a great solution for that. Buy something, display it, make other people jealous, right? That's the path to happiness that we're taught. It's deep in our bones, right? Because of this constant indoctrination. And it teaches us to look for happiness in catastrophic places that make us feel much worse. Think about Trump, right? I don't mean this as a cheap point about Trump, but he's a really powerful illustration of this. So in 2009, Melania Trump went to speak at NYU. I can't imagine why. And one of the students said to Melania Trump, "Would you have married Donald Trump if he wasn't rich?" And she said, "Do you think he would have married me if I wasn't beautiful?" And what I think is really interesting about that is an expression of these, I think it helps us to understand, firstly, how the Trumps exemplify these junk values. And secondly, one of the reasons why those junk values make us feel bad, right? Because it makes everything contingent. So what does that reveal? It reveals that Melania Trump knows if she got fat, if she lost her looks in some way, she'd be out the door. And of course, Donald Trump knows if he lost his money, if he lost his status, she'd be out the door. That's a very different kind of relationship to say, well, of course, I love my husband. Even if he got burned in a fire, he became homeless, whatever, right? It introduces a kind of capitalist contingency into your most intimate relationships, right? Now, that's one of many things that's going on with these junk values. But I think what you can see is a society that has been immersed in junk values, that has been taught to orient itself through life, where the individuals within it have been taught to orient themselves through life by always saying, what should I buy? What should I spend? How should I display it? Is going to be one that's profoundly unhappy and have a depression and anxiety epidemic. And that anxiety and depression epidemic is not because they're broken, because they're malfunctioning. Krishnamurti, the great Indian kind of philosopher, said, it's no sign of good health to be well adjusted to a sick society, right? I don't mean it as a glib point when I say, if you are anxious in a society where the most powerful person is Donald Trump, that's not a sign that you're crazy. That's a sign that you're sane, right? We've got to look at the corruption of values that has produced Trump, but also the corruption of values is one of the factors, and it's not the only one, that is driving the depression and anxiety epidemic. And so to relate that back to what you were asking about, you know, well, so there's very strong evidence financial insecurity causes depression, right? But equally, you think about junk values are disproportionately clustered at the top, not entirely, but actually, you know, Donald Trump is one of the wealthiest men in the United States. Even if you decide the obvious lies about his wealth, he still remains, even on the lower end of the estimate, extraordinarily wealthy. You can see how his constant questing for external signifiers of success and status is part of his profound unhappiness, right?
You think he's unhappy?
I've rarely seen a more unhappy human being.
Really? I worry that he might be happy.
No, because a happy person doesn't spend their whole life scanning their environment for threats and trivial things to rage about and ego, you know, kind of vanities of that kind. No, and it's quite clear he was horribly abused as a child, as you read when you read his stuff. It doesn't justify for a moment the monstrous things he does. But, you know, it reveals something about the kind of ultra-capitalist game that we're all meant to play, that the people who win the game are miserable as shit, right? Yeah. I mean, you could be Donald Trump, you can live in a golden palace, right? A golden literally a golden tower. You can be the most powerful man in the world. You can so commodify everything that you'd say you'd have sex with your own daughter if she wasn't your daughter, because your daughter's so hot, in inverted commas. And where does it leave you? It leaves you achingly miserable. Right? If winning the game still leaves you feeling terrible, that tells you something about how the nature of the game is profoundly flawed.
One of the disturbing things that you told me the last time I saw you was, you see, when you came to the United States to talk to people about the book, it was sometimes difficult to even get people to understand quite what you were saying and to think and to shake off like individualist or neoliberal assumptions. I mean, I think you were giving examples of people who sort of were talking about friendship in a kind of like utility maximizing way. And, oh, well, so you're saying that we would be maximizing our individual welfare if we did X, Y, and Z, but there's still these sort of buried assumptions about what it means to be a person in the world that it is really, really difficult to get out of people because the cliches about sort of neoliberalism being the sea we swim in are quite true. And there are these kinds of, there's this kind of real ideological, deep ideology that it's difficult to get people out of and to get them to see a different way.
Well, it's an interesting mixture, isn't it? So one of the things I think about a lot in relation to that is someone you and I hugely admire, Noam Chomsky's concept, a concept he came up with, one of many crucial concepts he came up with. He called it de-education. So he was talking about foreign policy. So you think about the time of Vietnam. He said, the higher up you go the education scale, the less you know about what's really going on in the world. So if you'd stopped a random person on the streets of Boston and said, does the American government lie to you and cheat? And, you know, is it just basically invading other countries to take their stuff or to subjugate them? Most ordinary working class Americans would have said, yeah, obviously. And then if you went to the faculty at Harvard, they would have had these extraordinarily elaborate, you know, justifications for, you know, why the US was doing what it was doing. So I like that de-education, that actually the education system de-educates you in that respect. And I think there's a similar thing with mental health, right? So, for example, to give the most banal and obvious example, one of the causes of depression that I write about in Lost Connections is loneliness. There is overwhelming scientific evidence, A, that loneliness causes depression and anxiety. A wonderful man called Professor John Cacioppo in Chicago did some of the leading research on this. I interviewed him a lot. And B, there's overwhelming evidence that loneliness has gone up enormously to the point where half of all Americans asked how many people know you well say nobody. Now, very few people dispute that. Right? It has happened to me. I did an interview with a kind of liberal NPR station. I was talking about how loneliness causes depression. And the interviewer said to me, well, this is a very controversial theory. And I remember thinking, this is what a bizarre culture this has become. But of course, what she meant is the biological story has eclipsed these much more common sense stories, right? And I want to stress again, I'm not saying there's no truth in the biological story, there's some truth in it. But what you can see is, I think what you've got is an interesting conflict, right? So you've got neoliberal ideology, which has conquered so much of the culture, which tells us we're all rational economic maximizers. You think about even the kind of banal self-help cliches we tell are so individualistic. Be you, be yourself, right? Actually, just being you makes you feel pretty shit. What we need to be us, be the group, right? But there's this interesting tension. So you've got the top-down conquest of neoliberalism, right, which is constantly promoted to us through the media. But neoliberalism is a system that doesn't meet our deepest needs as human beings, right? We're not that species. It makes me think a bit about Winston Churchill said or reportedly said about communism. Communism is a great theory. They just got the wrong species. It works pretty well with ants. And I think there's a kind of inversion of that. Although I agree with Churchill on that, which is one of the very few things I agree with Winston Churchill on, that and why the Nazis were bad are the only two things I agree with them on. But I think there's a kind of inversion of that, which is, you know, we are not a species that is compatible with neoliberalism, right? If you think about the context where we evolved in our primal and most basic psychological instincts evolved, Professor Cacioppo said this to me, you know, why do we exist? Why are you and I alive? One key reason is because our ancestors on the savannas of Africa were really good at one thing. They were bigger than the animals they took down. They weren't faster than the animals they took down, but they were much better at banding into groups and cooperating, right? In the circumstances where we evolved, if you got separated from the group, you were depressed and anxious for a really good reason. You were about to die. You were in terrible danger. Those are the instincts we still have. Just like bees evolved to live in a hive, humans evolved to live in a tribe. But then you get this neoliberal ideology that tells us we're all John Wayne on the horizon. By the way, even John Wayne wasn't that, and even the cowboys weren't that. That's in itself a bullshit myth. So we have this ideology that tells us to live one way, and yet, because that doesn't work, our underlying needs remain, right? So that ideology might conquer us, but then we feel like shit. There are many different societal configurations that don't meet people's needs. Soviet communism would be another very good example. In a different way, it didn't meet people's psychological needs, and most people were really, really unhappy and miserable. So I want to be clear, I'm not saying it's uniquely true of neoliberalism. But you think about neoliberalism, which has caused so much unhappiness, partly by causing the collapse of the middle class, partly by poisoning our values, by going through a whole range of factors that I talk about in Lost Connections. And then what happens? Because you've created a kind of grammar for the society that cannot see those causes, right? That cannot permit us to understand them. What you then have is a pathologization of the signal. So what you have is this society makes people feel like shit. Then it tells them these terrible feelings you have are just the product of something going wrong in your brain. And by the way, that's a great new opportunity for us to sell as a whole new $10 billion industry that will numb and anesthetize you to that pain, right? And stress again, I'm not saying there's no value in giving some people drugs, there's some value. But you can see how this frame works. I think about it a lot in relation to that Peter Thiel conference I went to. right? The rise of neoliberalism occurs at the same time as what's called the biomedical model of people's distress, which disproportionately tells people that it's all just a problem in your biology, or predominantly a problem in your biology, that predominantly needs to be dealt with drugs, right? And it's not conspiratorial. That's not, no one planned it that way. But you can see why an increasingly neoliberal society would want to lean more and more on the biomedical explanation for people's distress. Because actually, it depoliticizes their pain. What you've had is political changes that have made a lot of people feel like shit for perfectly good and understandable reasons. They should feel like shit in those situations. They're being humiliated. They're being made insecure. And the solution is to deal with that problem, to find the cow for their problems, right? But precisely because the society did not want to make, or rather the neoliberalism didn't want us to see that, you can see how it becomes much more convenient to just have this simplistic biological story. And I think a big part of what I want to do is restore to people faith in their own instincts. If you feel like shit in this society because you're really lonely and you've been told that life is all about buying things and showing them off, and because you're really financially insecure, don't let anyone tell you you feel bad just because something's wrong in your brain. Right? There may be something wrong in your brain as well, because biological factors interact with the social factors. They're not separate. But you see the point I'm making, Nathan?
Yes. Yeah? It's funny because I found that the best antidepressants in my life consistently has been the books and interviews of Noam Chomsky. Because, and I think you might be finding this because you're currently working on a biography of him. It's so refreshing when someone comes along and is able to make things clear for you and is able to point out what is actually going on and is able to make you feel like you're not actually crazy. And this is one of the things that I want to do, sort of my mission with Current Affairs is to help people feel like they're not crazy, to give people words of reassurance, to go, no, the thing that you suspect is true is actually true. And he's done that for me, and that's kind of what I want to pass along to people, because I think until we can fix the material and social causes of people's problems, which is a gigantic project. I mean, there are huge political implications to what you point out in the book, and if it's true that you can't solve things without a giant shift in the economic system and the values of society, then unfortunately that's going to mean that people are going to be unwell for a very long time. But what you can do is, at the very least, eliminate that sense that you say of blaming yourself and seeing everything internally and giving people a clear analysis and the reaction. Actions that we've gotten from readers. I get letters all the time from people going like, I feel better because I have a better understanding of what is going on, what is happening to me right now.
Yeah, there's a few things in what you said. I love the idea that whenever anyone's given a prescription for project, they should also be given a copy of manufacturing consent by law, right? Although Noam wouldn't approve of that because it'd be state coercion. But I think there's several things in what you're saying. So firstly, if you're depressed, your pain makes sense. Mm-hmm. One of the cruelest things about telling people this exclusively biological story is that it tells them your pain doesn't mean anything. It's like a glitch in a computer program. And there is overwhelming scientific evidence that that's not true, that we feel depressed and anxious for perfectly understandable reasons that are playing out for many people all around us. But I also think it's important to stress, I'm not saying, and the World Health Organization is not saying, you know, okay, so you've either got neoliberalism and profound despair, and the only solution is to have a complete revolution and change everything. And until we've got that, we're all condemned to be miserable. There are lots of interim steps we can take. So I'll give you some kind of very achievable short-term examples. One of the heroes in my book is a guy called Dr. Sam Everington. Sam is a general practitioner in East London, right? A poor part of East London where I lived for a long time. And Sam was really uncomfortable because he had loads of patients coming to him with horrible depression and anxiety. And like me, he's not opposed to chemical antidepressants. He thinks they have some role to play for some people. But he could see a couple of things. Firstly, that most of his patients were depressed and anxious for perfectly understandable reasons. Like they were really lonely, they were financially insecure, they'd been poisoned with the wrong values. And also he could see that chemical antidepressants gave some relief to some people, but they weren't solving the problem, right? That most people did become depressed again. So Sam decided to pioneer a different approach, which is now spreading all over Europe. One day, a woman came to see him called Lisa Cunningham, who I got to know pretty well later. And Lisa had been shut away in her home with crippling depression and anxiety for 7 years. And Sam said to Lisa, "Don't worry, I'll carry on giving you these drugs, but I'm also going to prescribe something else." There was an area behind the suite of doctor's offices that was known as Dogshit Alley, which gives you a sense of what it was like. It was just like scrubland. And Sam said to Lisa, "What I'd like you to do is come and turn out a couple of times a week at Dogshit Alley. I'm going to come too because I've been quite anxious. And we'll meet with a group of other depressed and anxious people and we'll think of something to do together, right?" The first time the group met, Lisa was literally physically sick with anxiety. But the group starts talking. They're like, "Okay, what can we do?" These are inner city East London people. They didn't know anything about gardening. They were like, "Okay, we're going to learn gardening," right? Mm-hmm. So they decided to learn gardening. They started to watch YouTube, read books. They started to get their fingers in the soil. They started to learn the rhythms of the seasons, right? And there's a lot of evidence that exposure to the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. But something even more important started happening. They started to form a tribe, right? They started to form a group. They started to care about each other. The way Lisa put it to me was, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. There was a study in Norway of a very similar program that found it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants, right? Now, that is much cheaper than what we do now. It costs literally nothing. It was a voluntary program. Mm-hmm. And it was twice as effective. And that approach is called social prescribing. It's now massively spreading in Britain and in lots of European countries. Now, you don't have to have a revolution to get people to do gardening programs, right? Or I'll give you one other example. It's not enough to deal with this problem of junk values, but it's a start. Professor Kasser did this really interesting research with a guy called Nathan Dungan, who I interviewed. He's in Minneapolis. Nathan's an interesting guy. He is a financial advisor, and he gives people advice on family budgeting, how you draw up a budget for your family. He got a call from a school in Minneapolis, a kind of middle-class school, and they said, "Look, we've got a big problem. The kids at our school are getting enraged if their parents can't buy them Nike sneakers or the latest iPhone or whatever it is, like really enraged. What can we do?" They initially asked him, "Would you come in and give these kids advice on budgeting?" So he comes in, he talks about budgeting and quickly realizes these kids don't give a shit about budgeting. They're still really angry if they don't get the sneakers or whatever. So that's when Nathan teamed up with Professor Kasser and they did this really interesting experiment. They just got people to meet once every couple of weeks. It was the teenagers and their parents in big groups. And the first thing they did was just said to them, make a list of everything you've got to have, right? They don't define what that means. And everyone puts, first of all, like a home, whatever. But quite quickly, people would put Nike sneakers or an expensive handbag or a fancy car, things which no sensible person actually does need, right? And they would say to them, okay, let's imagine you got those Nike sneakers. How would your life be different? And virtually nobody gave the ostensible reason for the object. No one said, oh, I play basketball and I'd be able to jump higher.
Right.
Right. Or no one's case for having the faster car was, oh, I'll be able to, in an emergency, I'll be able to drive faster in order to perform surgery. Right. They said things like, well, people will envy me. I'll have status. I'll feel I belong.
Right.
It's about emotional states. It doesn't take long for people to articulate that out loud, to go, well, where did you get this idea that having a purple tick on your plastic shoe would mean that you belonged, right? Just getting people to articulate these junk values mean they themselves spontaneously begin to take them apart. No one wants to be weak, right? Anyway, as these meetings go on, they then would talk about, okay, what are moments in your life that have been meaningful? Right? Moments when you have felt a deeper sense of satisfaction and joy. And, you know, people would name different things, playing music, running on the beach, writing, whatever it is, being with their kids. And they say, okay, how could we adjust your life so that you spend more time pursuing these meaningful values and less chasing these junk values, buying shit that you don't like and you don't need and won't ultimately make you happy? What was interesting is just that experience of having these conversations and checking back in, the kind of alcoholic synonymous for capitalism, right? Or for certainly for a kind of hyper-capitalist consumerism, led to a really significant reduction in these depression-causing values that was measured by the program, right? Now, again, you don't need to have a revolution to sit with your friends and talk about how can we change our lives so we do more meaningful things. That's a countercultural pressure, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, I go through loads of these, loads of options like that in the book. What I've seen is as people pursue those routes, it very often leads them to a deeper analysis, right? One of the few good things about the catastrophic situation we're in is all the alarm bells are going off, right? Mm-hmm. A society where one in three middle-aged women is taking an antidepressant on any given day, loads more are taking opioids and loads more feel like shit and are taking neither antidepressants nor opioids. That's an alarm signal, right? I think we have to profoundly change how we think about depression, anxiety, and addiction. These are not malfunctions. These are signals. They are telling us something about the society we've created. And we need to stop insulting the signal. We need to stop ignoring the signal and start listening to the signal and respecting the signal and hearing what it's telling us, right?
Yeah, that's a nice conclusion for us to wrap up on here. I think that's you're able to be both hopeful and at the same time. Yeah, because there's the thing you worry about. If you indict the entire values and economic system of the society, where do you go with that? You
know? But this is so important, Nathan. These are the values that are imposed on us. They're not the values of the society.
Oh, okay. Sorry, yeah.
If they were the values of ordinary people, right, then we'd be fine. We'd be happy, right?
Yeah.
It's precisely because those aren't our... Because at some level,
right,
aren't our values, what we all have a job of disentangling, and I have a job of disentangling it in myself, never mind in the society, is the neoliberal value. And look, I'm not naive about this. Some aspects of neoliberalism are innate to us, right? Of course, there are impulses towards selfishness and a kind of hardcore individualism in all of us, right? Of course, this is part of being human. So it's not just something that's imposed from outside. But the conquest of those values at the expense of everything else, the kind of Ayn Randization of the culture.
Gushing is evil.
And also a really good illustration of a profoundly unhappy...
So unhappy!
Have you read literally the funniest book ever written, which everyone listening to this podcast, forget about my book, go and read it now, Nathaniel Brandon's memoir?
I have not read Nathaniel, but I've read a biography of him, but I have not read his memoir.
Oh my God. So just to explain to you, Nathaniel Brandon was this quite hot guy who was like 30 years younger and was part of her cult, much hotter than Alan Greenspan, who was also in the cult. And she had an affair with him. And at some point it got to the point where she was like 80 and he just couldn't bring himself to fuck her anymore. And she said to him, there's a line in it, I'm going to get it slightly wrong, but I've always longed to be able to say this line to someone. She said something like, the actual sentence is even better, it's in the book. It's saying like, if you reject me sexually, you are rejecting the entire tradition of Western philosophy going back to Plato. And I've always
loved
to say that to a man in some context, right? In fact, next time I'm sexually rejected, I promise you listeners, I will do that. Yeah, look, let's think about Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand was such a terrible, selfish person who did, in fact, live by the values she professed. Did.
No one can say that she was a hypocrite.
She wrote a book called The Virtue of Selfishness. How does Ayn Rand die? Ayn Rand was so awful to everyone that everyone abandoned her, and she dies alone, except there was someone who she paid to be by her death. Right? I wonder if in her final moments when Ayn Rand looks up at this person who's only there because he's being paid almost certainly minimum wage, I would imagine as well. Did even Ayn Rand in her dying moments think, this is a good way to go? I really doubt it, because we're not that species, right?
Yeah.
A society of Ayn Randian individualists would have died out on the savannas of Africa long ago. We wouldn't be having this conversation, right? I'm indicting the values that have been imposed on the society that activate the worst in us. And it's there in us. Mm-hmm. I'm not indicting the individuals within the society. The individuals within the society are experiencing a silent rebellion against those values, right? That's one of the reasons why we're so unhappy and why so many people voted for the burn the house down candidate, right? For Trump, which is obviously something I'm completely opposed to. But I think all the time about this woman that I met in Cleveland. I was with this group of people who were trying to get out the vote in the run-up to the election. And there was one door, it was a house in West Cleveland. We're on one of these streets where a third of the houses were abandoned, a third had been demolished, and a third still had people living in them. And we knocked on one door. I was with a great guy called Dave Fleischer from the LA LGBT Center. And this woman answered, who I would have guessed from looking at her was 60. I discovered from talking to her, she was the same age as me. I was 37 at the time. She was quite articulate. There was no way she was going to vote for the Democrats. Really angry. And she made this verbal slip that's really stayed with me. She was talking about what the area used to be like for her parents and grandparents. How they left school when they were 16. They got decent jobs. They, you know, lived in a nice neighborhood. And she meant to say when I was young. But what she actually said is when I was alive. And she didn't notice. It really knocked me and Dave looked at each other. It really knocked me back, right? And I thought that is how lots of people in this society feel, right? And they're not wrong. And if all we do is yell at them and say, you're racist, you're stupid, And that woman was quite racist. You know, she was. Not everyone in her situation is, to be sure. But then we're missing what's going on, right? We're missing a huge part of what's going on, that people are distressed for perfectly understandable reasons. Actually, a species of people who wasn't distressed when they became humiliated, horrendously financially insecure, lonely, told that life was about buying things and showing them off. That would be a weird species. Who wants to be part of that species, right? It's a reason why Brave New World is a dystopia, not a utopia, right? We need our instincts. We don't want to pathologize our instincts. We want to honor them.
I agree with everything you said.
I'm glad to know that I now have the official Nathan Robinson endorsement for all things that I henceforth say.
Okay, people should pick up your books, Lost Connections and Chasing the Scream. You also have a Patreon, don't you? For people to give money, patreon.com/YohanHari, where they can get exclusive bits of the book that are cut and previews of your upcoming work.
I should spell out my name as well, because JohanHari. I also had this weird experience at the end of an interview recently where they said to me, what's your Instagram? What's your Facebook? What's your Twitter? All of that shit. And they said, what's your Snapchat? And I was like, I am a 40-year-old man, right? The only 40-year-old men on Snapchat are certainly pedophiles and should be immediately arrested.
There was a moment in the Hillary Clinton campaign where they said, for one day only, Bill Clinton will be taking over the campaign Snapchat. And I thought, that is a bad idea.
I think I'll literally have nightmares about that. It probably made...
Yeah, so they can't see your Snapchat, but they can follow you on Twitter and other things, yeah. What's the next book coming up? Or are they years away now?
So I have just signed I'm just in the process of signing the deal to do it. But as you know, I have been for the last 5 years, I've been working on a biography of Noam Chomsky, someone who really changed my mind and changed about lots of things and changed my life. So I've been interviewing Chomsky for the last 5 years, and I've interviewed 250 people in his life in 12 countries now. And that will take many years. It turns out linguistics is really complex. Who knew? I really feel like it's worth honouring Chomsky's life by doing this in as much depth as I possibly can. So I will probably be known as 90 and going strong. I'll probably be slightly older than Chomsky is now than when I finish it. But I'm working on that. And I've just signed a deal to do a book on a subject that I can't talk about because it's something quite specific and I don't want anyone else to swoop in and write about it. So... happy days.
All right, thanks, Johan. I really, truly appreciate you getting
I really love Current Affairs. Hooray!
Hooray!
Thanks for listening. Remember, this interview is released as part of our new fundraising campaign. Please consider donating to help Current Affairs get to the next level as we expand our coverage, overhaul our website, and offer new reporting, better magazines, and more great interviews like the one you've just heard. Visit kickstarter.com/project/804992239/help-current-affairs-expand-in-2020 or just check the show notes. Thanks for listening.